Hello, everyone. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling. My name is John McAdam. When Sean and I first started doing this show, we recorded an episode where, if for whatever reason we couldn't record that week, we would put that show on. Well, guess what? This is the week finally came along where we could not record. So I don't want to make you guys think that we're pulling like old stuff out of the refrigerator and giving you leftovers. It is a first-run show, and it's pretty good. It's about the 1984 top 100 wrestlers in the world as picked by the Wrestling Observer newsletter. We'll be back doing WWF 1981 again next week, and we are looking forward to it. Enjoy your week, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling. My name is John McAdam. I am here with Sean Goodwin. And, Sean, we found something good to talk about, did we not?
Well, what's your definition? Let's change the word. How about interesting?
Interesting is usually good. Unless it's a dead body, I guess.
That's fair enough. Because But anyway, go ahead.
Depends on who the dead body is.
Exactly.
All right.
So what did you find in the McAdam vault?
I found the top 100 from 1984 from the Wrestling Observer newsletter, and let me clarify what that is. It is based strictly on work rate. It was done with a poll of either 97 or 98 people, so it's not, just Meltzer. It's a whole bunch of people. It's supposed to be a ranking from January 1st, 1984 through January 31st, December 31st, 1984. And I think it's kind of impossible to leave out biases. And, what you saw in 1982 is going to have an impact on that. But you also have to remember that this was taken at the end of 84, probably more like the beginning of 1985. So these guys haven't had time to watch the videotapes over and over again as we have had the opportunity to do for 34 years. So if there's a ranking that's a little bit screwed up or whatever, I'm going to be very forgiving of that.
Oh, get ready to be forgiving.
Well, it's true, though, and you have to kind of look at this through the eyes of someone who's looking at it on January 1st, 1985. And you also have to remember, too, that, a lot of these matches, I'll bet a lot of these rankings are based on nothing but reputation. Like, you have to go back. In 1985, you didn't get every wrestling promotion available out there on your television set. You were relying on videotapes. If not, you were relying on word of mouth.
Okay. Now, just again, because I do want to clarify one point you made, which is important in this discussion, is that what you're watching, like, these guys are the hardcores who are voting on this, right? I mean, this is heavy tape trader guys. Were you a voter on this?
I was not. I did not enter upon the scene until about I can tell you I got my first Wrestling Observer newsletter December 1986. So this is like 2 years before my time.
Okay. So,
hey, you know what?
But basically, your normal.
I need to plug our Facebook page, Stick to Wrestling Facebook page at Facebook. It's easy to find, but you go right ahead, Sean.
Yep, and we are both there on that. So if, like I said, if you want to, call us an idiot for some reason, it's happened before. So feel free.
And it'll happen again. But
oh, absolutely, I have no doubt.
The Wicked Cool podcast, and it's our Wicked Cool Facebook page.
Indeed. So, but most bands are – we were both in the Boston area in 1984, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so in 1984, what was our viewing options? Just so you know our biases.
Okay, our viewing options, number one, of course, was WWF Wrestling on Channel 56. They had Championship Wrestling and All-Star Wrestling. We had World Class Championship Wrestling. We had ICW. That didn't start until 1985. I take that back. And let me think. I don't think there was anything else in 1984.
Mid-South?
We didn't get Mid-South. Not in 84, at least. I'm trying to think of what else, but man, I think that's it. Oh, and of course we had WTBS on cable, which 1984 was kind of a giant mess. We had All American Wrestling on cable. We had TNT on cable, which was a total travesty in my opinion. I'm trying to think of what else, but I think that's it.
So heavy WWF. I did not get cable until 1984. I got it right around Black Saturday. So okay. I don't have a deep recollection of Georgia when I was a kid. So we didn't get JCP until 1985 in April.
That is correct. You ready for total sacrilege? I think Georgia was overrated. The whole time I thought Georgia was overrated.
From
what
year?
All of them in general. I mean, they had great moments in 1980, 81, etc., but I never thought it matched up to Florida. I never thought it matched up to Mid-South.
The problem with Georgia is I think their best stuff is not available. And by the time they got to the 80s, cable, I think, killed them because they ended up having to think they had to cater their product to a national audience.
Maybe. I mean, it seemed rather regional. When we got it October 1981, and, you know, a lot of people might say, oh, you know, Northerners, you know, they need a national product that appeals to the people in the Northeast. Everyone I knew who watched the Georgia promotion loved the Southern flavor of it.
Yeah, but if you I guess compared to WWF, it's a little Southern flavor. But if you take the Georgia product and compare it to Memphis,
okay,
where they're talking
yeah.
about, you know, we'll see you down at the furniture store down the street. I mean, that was like they were, and I think that Georgia was like that too back in the 70s. By the time we started getting it, TBS started becoming more national. They started bringing in the National Heavyweight Championship for that reason.
Yes.
And it started to broaden out because I think that was the closest thing you had to a national promotion back then.
Oh, it definitely was. I mean, wrestlers would go out of their way they would go on their own dime to travel to Atlanta to make sure they got that national exposure. I remember Buddy Rose talking about that.
There was a quote from Ric Flair who said how Harley told him. He said, make sure you get on Barnett's TV.
Yeah, and I mean, Terry Funk personally told me that in 1979, he came home to Amarillo and he turned on TV and WTBS was on, and he's like, I'm selling my local promotion because the territories are done.
Georgia at that time in the early 80s was the beginning. That was kind of the template for what's the more vague, the more, you know, kind of a national type of promotion where it wasn't very specialized, like a Memphis would be, or Portland would be, or St. Louis. You know,
yeah.
You have a very specialized style. They tend to, that style got blurred in Georgia, much like it is in WWF. They took away that kind of personal feel. And this is, again, why I keep saying that I think a regional promotion could work, because you could bring that personal touch back, which was always very effective. And I think that's what you're talking about when you're saying the stuff that you saw in Georgia is overrated.
I think it was overrated because Georgia wrestling, and I loved it, make no mistake. I mean, I had many, you know, it started up here when I was a junior in high school, and I had many a girlfriend sitting there at, like, you know, 7:55 saying, what the hell am I doing watching wrestling? Let's go have some fun. I'm like, no, 10 more minutes. You know, so I'm not knocking it, but the Georgia promotion to me was, you know, squash, interview, squash, interview, squash, interview.
It was bland.
Yeah.
There was something bland about it.
And again, I've said this on the show before, calling something overrated, I'm not saying it sucks. I'm saying that it's just the people's opinion of it is a little bit inflated in my opinion. And again, it's my perception of other people's perceptions. But anyway,
I just think it was bland. I think it was bland because you have to appeal to the largest audience possible. So you want to take all those little nuances out that a Memphis would have, or a St. Louis, or a Dallas. In Dallas started to do it too.
I mean, WWF totally did it in 1984 they kind of got away from their ethnic babyface formula and went to, you know, just like you're saying, a little bit watered down.
In previous episodes, we had talked about, we had made reference to a Mrs. Krieger at Madison Square Garden. Yeah, Mrs. Krieger went away, didn't she?
Everyone went away. Everyone who purchased their had those ringside seats at Madison Square Garden reserved, they no longer had that privilege.
He washed out the entire flavor of that old show. I mean,
so
they like
even, to be in the front row.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean literally, that whole kind of personal, that territorial personal touch. That's why I like 70s WWF. WWF. I think it's a pretty good product. You know, it's not, you know, Florida, but it's a good product. That was the difference, though. It still felt like a territory.
It's terrible, and I loved it, and I grew up with it, and it's terrible, but that's okay.
It's not terrible. It can't be fun, but we understand it because we grew up in the area, and we understand those the local nuances they have to it.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I watch it and I'm entertained by it, but I used to work with a girl who was a WWF fan. She loved the Hardy Boys, and she was watching WWF. I was 24/7 at the time, and she was watching one of the old WTBS shows. And she was like, how did you guys watch this stuff? It's awful. And it's like, no, that's the point. It's awful. It's great.
No. But no, I did like that party, but it was back then, it was more of a territory.
Yeah, it was what it was, and it worked, and that's all that matters. Yeah. I mean, I can be as critical as I want of the old AWA. I mean, it just didn't appeal to me, but it appealed to the people in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, et cetera, and that's all that matters.
Wrestling styles are their own language. You can pretty much, if you have a guy and you like, if you have him watch some kind of wrestling thing, or he's a wrestling fan, you have him watch, and he picks out the stuff he likes, you can almost guess where he's from.
That's true. That's totally true.
Yeah, I mean, if you show him a match, it doesn't have to be in his territory, but if you show him a match, whether it's a scientific one, a brawl, whatever, and he picks out the one he likes, you're like, oh, yeah, you're from Texas, or you're from – because each promotion had their very specific style to it. That's not the case anymore.
Yeah, it's the way the world works. I mean, I you're too young to understand this, but there used to be like a solid Boston music scene. I mean, we had some really good bands in Boston. There used to be a Los Angeles scene. There used to be a New York scene. Those days are over. It's just like wrestling. It's like a lot of other things.
No. That kind of gives you an idea of our perspective. So if we, you know, go off on, you know, so you have an idea of who we've seen a good deal of and who we haven't.
Exactly. So we've got Meltzer's top 100, and what we're going to do is we're just going to talk about it for until our hour expires. We're definitely not going to get to number 100. We're probably not going to get to number 12, but whatever. Number one in 1984. Take a moment to think about who it's going to be. I think it's really obvious.
Yeah, of course. That's no argument. You put anybody else at one, you're going to look foolish.
Exactly. I mean, Rick had so many great years in the business, but 1984 is the year he finally came to New York and had New Jersey, but it's just right across the river, and had a meaningful match against someone. I was there. It was a classic against Ricky Steamboat. He held the NWA title the entire year except for the three-week Kerry Von Erich thing. And just, you know, solid, sensational. When he came on WTBS, you knew you were seeing a superstar.
Yep, never bad. The basement was very good in 1984. That was as low as you were getting.
Yeah, and Rick considers this, according to his book, like his first real run. It was almost like his first run, which began in 1981 and ended like June 1983, he felt was almost a test run. He felt he wasn't a draw. He felt he wasn't ready. And he was like, this time he was ready to be the man. I actually enjoyed his first run, but Rick felt like this was it for him. And I agree with him. He was just fantastic.
Just look at the way he won the belt both times. The first time was in, what was it? It was in St. Louis, right? Against Kansas City.
Yep.
Nothing Town back then. Yeah, in wrestling parlance, Nothing Town against Dusty Rhodes. A nothing crowd because it's a championship match, I guess. But I mean, they don't know who either guy is, really.
They've both been to Kansas City before, but you're right. Kansas City was not a big wrestling town.
It's an odd choice for this match.
And
you know, then you have the second one, which was the coronation, basically.
Yeah, and back then, NWA title switches came out of nowhere 100% of the time. There was no buildup, or if there was a buildup, it was a regional buildup. And you're right, in Starrcade, they had a giant buildup, and really, you know, there's no way Ric Flair, if you were watching Mid-Atlantic Wrestling in 1983, you know there was no way Ric Flair was not coming out of that without the belt.
No, not at all. So, yeah, there's no question. Rick's number one in 1984. That's what it is. Okay, now let's get to the fun. Who's number two?
Number two, according to the panelists, is the Dynamite Kid.
Where was the Dynamite Kid in 1984?
Mostly in Japan. Calgary, Portland. Was he even in Portland anymore? I think he finished up in Portland.
Yeah. I think he was mostly...
This is based on the strength of his matches against Sayama in Japan, and based on, I would say, a lot of the votes from 1984 probably came from 1983. Had he started with the WWF yet? I think he started like early 85, but I could be mistaken.
Yeah, it was either very late 84 or early 85. It wouldn't have been in time to affect this. That's what I was going to ask before I went off on it. Okay, I'm going to go off on number three. Go ahead.
No, I'm going to say I am not going to say that this ranking is wrong. I mean, Dynamite had so many good matches in 84 against Tiger Mask, and these matches were so ahead of their time.
Did they have the Super J yet?
I do not believe so.
Okay. So, yeah, okay, those matches are famous. I was basically looking to see if it was that year when he had the matches with it was that year. Fine. I won't argue that one. Three. Okay, what's the fetish with Brody? With the old school, you know, Wrestling Observer guys? come on. Three? Why is Brody three?
Okay, I can tell you why he's three. Number one, I think there was a little bit of and this is going to go for all of the vote ballot. There was definitely in the observer culture in 84, definitely an anti-WWF feel about it. I mean, it was the first year McMahon went national and put on that ridiculous TNT show, and I think a lot of what was going on is sticking to the WWF, and Brody was anti-WWF. At the same time, and I've said this before, Bruiser Brody, we've gotten to the point where he's been called overrated so many times that I believe he is truly the most underrated wrestler of all time right now, because he was really good. He had awesome matches. He had an awesome presence. I mean, I can't... Here's the thing. I can't tell you exactly which matches he had in 84.
I was waiting for that. I knew you were going to do that.
I'm being honest.
He had awesome matches. I can't remember them, but I mean, because I was about to say,
he had an awesome match against Inoki in 84.
And he had the Flair match and then St. Louis. That was 84 too, right? Or was that 82?
Actually, I think that was January 85. Came right out and said, you know, at the beginning of this, that a lot of this is going to be reputation on January 1st, 1985.
I know, but you guys, Bruiser Brody's reputation is built on the Wrestling Observer nationally. I mean, they just were so overall, they have awards named after Brody. They made up an award just for him.
But that's true. And you know what? After Brody was killed, I think that's when the Brody is overrated. That's when the Brody mania really caught fire. And I believe it was right after he was killed that they named Best Brawler after him.
And fine for that reason. But I'm just saying, it's the reason he's getting underrated now is because he was so wildly. He was a nice featured attraction. I know people associated with Hansen. Stan is so much better than Bruiser Brody. It's not. It's ridiculous. I mean, Stan can do. You know, the one thing they both have in common is they're both reasonably likely to injure somebody. But that's just because Stan's blind as a bat.
Yeah, I look at Hansen, and I mean, I look at his WWF run, not his 76 run, because I don't have enough of it, but I look at his 80-81 run, and I see that guy, and I'm like, man, he's, I don't want to say he's not that good, but I mean, those matches against Backlund were disappointing. That cage match against against Backlund in Madison Square Garden was a flat-out stinker, and to the point where
he didn't have
people,
the act down yet.
Oh,
he didn't have that character down yet. I mean, that awesome.
And the cage match against Backlund was such a stinker that people were like, wow, did both guys have the flow?
He didn't. I you watch it back then, and he's a glorified Bobby Duncan back then.
But he's still a major attraction in Japan already.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, did Bobby Duncan ever go? Because if he did, he would have been huge too.
Bobby Duncan went to Japan. Think about this. Brody and Hansen started right around the same time.
Yep.
They actually teamed in the WWF in 76 and 77.
Mm-hmm. I do remember seeing that result somewhere. But Stan hadn't got the character down yet. By the early 80s, he was starting to get the crazy down. You know, and, you know, then he'd have the great run in the AWA with the, you know, where he gives that eloquent reason as to why he wrestles. Do you remember that?
Of course I do. With a fat wife and 90 kids.
Nine screaming kids. I mean, he hadn't gotten that down yet. You start getting that in Georgia a little bit. Then they kept using him as a face.
He was an effective baby face.
I know, but he's such a better heel, though. So I don't get the Brody. He's good. Yes, he's good. He's a great attraction to bring him in. If you put him in with the right guy, he'll get you a good match. If he's interested and if he likes the guy. If he doesn't like the guy, then it's just going to be a big pain. I mean, y'all laugh at the thing with Lex Luger, and I do too, because it's Lex Luger, but still. You can't be doing that.
I get it. You don't do that. But like I said, I mean, you know, let me ask you this. We've got Flair at one, we've got Dynamite at two, which you were lukewarm with, and that's fine. This is all about opinions. I mean,
well, and I take away my lukewarmness once I found out the year. Once I found out this was that year, fine, I take it off. He's fine at two.
Who is the wrestler you feel that Brody is egregiously rated ahead of?
Number six.
Who is number six?
Ricky Choshu.
Now here's a guy that I thought was too high on the list. I just never got into Choshu.
He carried the whole operation.
But we're talking
he was like the man
in ring.
The Due Machina. I think he was very good in the ring. He told it. He was more like a Jerry Lawler good. It was interesting to watch him because when I saw him, he seemed very Americanized to me. I mean, stylized in the way he performs. I think that's why kind of he went over as much as he did. He seemed very Western, which is why I'm surprised he didn't try a run here. But in the ring, he was like a Lawler good. He told a good story.
I'm cool with that. But number six over the entire year, there's only five guys better than you.
This was like the height of like Ricky right here.
Okay.
I mean, that whole Choshu's Army thing. Was right about here.
I think is egregiously underrated here is number 10, Ricky Steamboat. And you're going to say, hey, you're basing this on 1989. You're basing this on, you know, Steamboat's reputation from the 70s.
Nope, I'm not going to say that at all because he had a very fine feud with Tully Blanchard that year.
He had the Starcade match with Tully Blanchard, which was easily the best match on that show.
Yep.
He had the Meadowlands match against Ric Flair, which at the time I saw it was the best match I'd ever seen by a long shot. And just in general, I mean, he's Ricky Steamboat. He's great.
Okay, so to finish the question, Stan Hansen should be above Brody. Ricky Steamboat, I agree, should be above Brody. Terry Gordy should be above Brody.
Okay, let's talk about Terry Gordy. He is ranked number 11, and I actually agree with you. I would put him ahead of Brody, not because of any of Brody's weaknesses, because Gordy was incredible in 1984. One of the best matches of the year was Terry Gordy against Kerry Von Erich when Kerry was NWA champion. One of the best matches of the year was Terry against Killer Khan, which we talked about on this show.
Oh, that match.
Yeah,
that traumatized me. There are a few matches from back then I could close my eyes. I can remember every bit of it. That was the most gruesome match I've ever seen up until that time.
He had
and for a long time after.
In early 1984 against Kevin Von Erich, which was just off the charts. So I agree. Terry Gordy is egregiously underrated at number 11.
Dick Slater.
Out of order, of course, because we're us.
Yep,
but
Dick Slater.
Number four is Super Tiger, Satoru Sayama. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a great year for him. There's another one. I put him ahead of Brody.
Yeah, I think, you know what? He peaked in like 81, 82. He had some fantastic matches in 83.
But Dynamite got a good year out of him.
This is one I'm going to call, this is a reputation ranking. I don't think in 1984 he was number four. I don't think in 1984 he was top 10. Because I was talking about the matches with Dynamite Kid, and I made a mistake. Those great matches were in 1983. So
that's what I was thinking.
Okay. So I think Dynamite probably got a reputation ranking, and so did Sayama. Because
okay, fair
I think
enough.
At this point, was he done with New Japan at this point? I think he was.
I think so. I'm not a Japan expert.
All right,
this, but I have seen the matches between those two are fantastic. So I was thinking it was that year. If it's afterwards, I'm going to go back to my point of Dynamite's too high. But my complaint here is Brody. Is that's
right.
A three? I'm still basically this is going to be the who's higher than Brody. Who's higher than Brody show? Because I'm going through the list now, like picking bunches of guys now. Is Dickie Slater?
Slater was never better than Brody, and I love Slater.
Oh, stop it. 1984 was fantastic. That was his best year.
What was... I don't think it was his best year. What did he do in 1984 that like came
he was the U.S. champion.
He was U.S. champion.
No, I thought he was really good that year. Well, but I would agree. I'd say almost 83. He was such a great villain with flair.
All right. Number five, we have Davey Boy Smith, who was really coming into his own in Japan. Number six,
I haven't seen enough.
All right, that's cool. Six, we talked about Ricky Choshu. I think he's a little bit high, but, you know. Number seven, Hacksaw Butch Reed.
Not egregious. I'd say 10, but I mean, there's some guys I put ahead of him, but he was good. I don't want to be taking anything. This is a real good year for Butch.
It was an awesome year for Butch Reed. Butch looked like he was, I mean, he turned heel in 1983, and I've said this on the show before. I think in order to be, by 1984, in order to be a really top of the card superstar babyface, you have to be a heel first. They turned him heel in 1983. He, according to the storyline, ran Junkyard Dog out of Mid-South Wrestling, and he was the boss. He was the top guy in Mid-South, no questions asked. And they turned him at the end of 1984 babyface. And
Landell, right?
Landell and more Skandor Akbar, but Buddy Landell, and it looked like Butch Reed was ready to take over the world. He looked like a future NWA champion.
Absolutely, he looked like the next big thing. So yeah, I guess I have no. If I wanted to pick it apart, maybe go down to 10. But yeah, you're in the ballpark there. Yeah, I don't want to pick on him here. That was a good year for him.
You know what? Well, let's go down a dangerous road. It's 1984, and no, it's 1985. You're Jim Crockett. You just took over
the time slot on WTBS. So let's pretend, I mean, we're going into an alternate reality here where Crockett is not attached to Dusty Rhodes. If you're Jim Crockett, do you look at Butch Reed and do you say, I bring this guy in and build my promotion around him?
If I only have Dusty Rhodes, I would have, by 1985, I would have, when I made the purchase, I would have brought Watts with it.
Good point. I mean, that's its own series of shows right there. But I'm dancing around the fact that Butch Reed was black. And 1985, you've got, you know, Michael Jackson's on top of the world. Michael Jordan has just exploded. Why not do what Bill Watts did and build your promotion around a black babyface?
Well, that's where I was going with it, by saying that you bring in Watts on that move. And then would Watts do it? Yeah, I think Watts would do it, which is kind of an interesting alternate universe of what would happen to the JCP show. If they, you know, if for some reason, say Crockett and Dusty had a fight or something like that, some kind of a falling out about whatever. And they, at that time, and they bring in Watts, and Watts, I mean, as opposed to basically eliminating all the Mid-South guys, actually gives them a break.
You know, the whole time JCP was around, I mean, they tried, when they brought Lex Luger in, the idea was they were going to make him their Hulk Hogan. And all Lex Luger could have ever done, and I like Lex Luger, don't get me wrong, all he would have, his ceiling would have been a second-rate Hulk Hogan impersonation. With, if they had brought in Butch Reed and made him their number one guy, and I mean number one, NWA champion, Ric Flair's not number one, Butch Reed was number one, I think they could have gone places. He could have been their answer to Hulk Hogan.
And in that role, JYD was just out of the question at this point, because by 1985, forget about it, it was over. So Butch was the man.
Yeah.
I absolutely think, I mean, he was that good. He was a good baby face. The best part about him as a baby face and heel is he didn't change. He was like Lawler. He had the exact same personality. He was just fighting different people.
Yeah. I mean, you would watch Butch Reed on TV and you'd be like, you know, man, I'm looking at a bad dude. You were looking at a bad dude. I mean, he was, you know, a linebacker at Missouri State.
But that makes the best. That makes the best tweener combination, because do you remember a guy named Kenny Linsman?
Ken Linsman, he Bruins?
He was a hockey player for the Bruins. He was known as the Rat.
Okay.
He was one of those guys. He was just a filthy, dirty player. And he was one of those guys, if he's on your team, you love him. And if he's on the other guy's team, you hate his guts. That's like what Butch was. And like what Lawler was, too. But that's like what Butch was. He could do both, and he never changed his personality. He was basically the same guy.
You know what, though? Like, when Butch Reed was a heel, this was a heel you respected, because you could tell, man, this guy was real. He was a tough dude.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this wasn't the cowardly heel. That's what I'm trying to say, and there was no personality change. He was the same bad man either way. Okay, if he was against you, you hated him, but you kind of wish he was on your side, which is why his face turn was so good.
Yeah.
Because they wanted him to be on their side.
Face turn.
Yeah, because it's one of those guys you're looking at like, oh, if he could just be on our side.
Yeah, he was, you know, he was his own man. He wasn't going to listen to Skandor or Akbar. He wasn't going to put up with Buddy Landell. I mean, Buddy Landell is a little buddy. It was one thing, but when Buddy, you know, his feet got too big for his shoes, Butch smacked him.
It was the perfect storyline for someone like him to go completely independent. Actually, Dusty's was the same thing, wasn't it? When he turned.
Yeah.
His face turn was
similar.
The fact that, you know, he was getting crowded, you know. And, you know, I think Lawler's done that one, too.
Yeah, I agree.
Where, you know,
number eight, Tatsumi Fujinami, is the guy I would have at number two.
I was going off on that tangent to try to avoid you saying number eight. I will
you
take your word for it.
It's completely forgivable. Look, this show is not about Japan wrestling. It's not about Mexico wrestling. So we're cool with that. I've seen enough of Fujinami in 84 to say, wow, this guy was an electric worker. Number nine is Stan Hansen, who we talked about. Number 10 is Ricky Steamboat, who we talked about. Number 11 is Terry Gordy, who we talked about. Number 12 is the Cobra, George Takano, who I can tell you right now, he was really good, but I can't frame 1984 for you on that one. Number 13, Paul Orndorff.
It. Another guy who had it, just like Butch. You could feel it coming. You look back then, you just, oh, he had it.
I'll tell you something, and I really think this. 1984 Paul Orndorff being ranked that high is based on his reputation, because he was dynamite in Mid-South like 80, 81. He was dynamite Georgia 82, early 83. He slowed down in the WWF in the 84. He was still really good, but I don't think number 13 overall really good.
I guess, but they didn't know how to use him, though. In the beginning, at least. I'm not sure. You know what? Until 1986, I'm not sure they ever knew how to use Paul.
They did. They had on TNT, I know I hate this show, but they had this incredible segment where Paul Orndorff went to the gym and he went to train, like, I don't know, four or five, like, normal people at the gym. And Paul's natural arrogance and conceit just made itself clear. I mean, he was such a dick. It was incredible. It was a memorable segment, and you could tell he had nothing but legitimate contempt for the people he was working at the gym with.
My more problem with him in 84 is, again, how he was used. I think he was still great, as you just said. I mean, he was still the same guy. They just, again, maybe they were setting him up for Piper. That whole thing. I don't know how far back in advance they had that match set up.
Probably not at all, knowing the old WWF.
And Orndorff was going to have to naturally take a back seat to Piper.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was 2 years away from one of the biggest money feuds ever.
You know, the thing with Orndorff, he was the last of a long series of the way the WWF used to do things. They would bring in a heel, give him a manager, and have him do a series of matches against Bruno and Backlund, and he was the last one. He was supposed to be managed by the Grand Wizard in 1983. Wizard passed on, so he didn't have a manager. He was originally scheduled to just, you know, do a series against Backlund and then, you know, then wind down and go home, and then Vince changed the formula.
That makes a lot of sense. He had a limbo feel to him. Like they weren't exactly sure, because, you know, we're going to bring him in for one thing and then it changed. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because that's how it felt.
Yeah, so, he had the series against Hogan, which was actually a one and done at Madison Square Garden. And then it's like, okay, well, we've changed the formula. What do we do with this guy now? And they kept him strong.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm just saying, I still think he was every bit as good a performer. Maybe you're right, a little high, but I think it was more his positioning and their lack of focus on what to do with him than him himself.
All right, number 14 is an all-time favorite of mine, Adrian Adonis. 1984, Adonis's main role was in a tag team with Dick Murdoch in the WWF, and that was an all-time great tag team.
Classic tag team. That was the first tag team chance I remember as a kid, and they're probably still my favorite. Just so obnoxious, and it was great.
So
you had
underhanded.
They both
so much, and I.
Oh,
loved
it was
it.
Fantastic. It was just, you know, it was. They had Albano, right?
Yes, they eventually had Albano,
and you know, and that was the whole thing with the Samoans.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, no, this was one of the best tag teams, and he came off of a really good tag team in Ventura, where he was basically the entire wrestling portion of it. And then he had a great 82. So this is a good run for him. Part of it's reputation. Part of it's he's still pretty good. That's about right, I would say, for Adrian.
I you know what? Here to me, and I always hate
a little high, maybe, but
Adonis, I think this was a little bit of a reputation pick. Because Adonis in 82, maybe 83, was arguably the best wrestler in the world. And I'm talking could maybe even better than Ric Flair. He was phenomenal. And I think in 84, he had some really good matches. But again, it's the WWF. They slow things down.
And there's a usage thing. Part of his reputation, part of it's the fact that just wasn't his fault. He was still very good for what he was given to do. And I'd say it's a reputation, a bit of it, but not as egregious as the Brody one.
No,
14 is – you're in the ballpark.
I agree with that. Two quick things about Adonis, just my opinion. Number one, people talk about, you know, he and Ventura, okay, Jesse did the talking and Adrian did the wrestling. Adrian Adonis was an excellent interview. I don't care what anyone says. And we're talking, you know, the East-West connection days. People act like Jesse carried things on the mic, and he just did not. Adrian held his – he held his end of it. Number two, Adrian became nothing short of obese at some point in his career. Like when he was in the AWA in like 87, he had to weigh 340, 350 pounds. Most of it was gut, and he could still go.
Incredibly agile for a big guy. Even when he got to that, he was huge when he was in AWA, even by the end of his WWF run.
Yeah. Absolutely. He was just out of control. And I've always heard that Adonis was one of those naturally bad body guys. He's athletic, but he's never going to be a bodybuilder. And at some point, he just got tired of trying not to be fat while still being fat. So he just said, screw it. I'm not going to, do cardio. I'm going to eat whatever I want. And that's when, he ballooned.
I mean, he didn't exactly look like, this wasn't the great bodybuilder team of Murdoch and, this wasn't the body Donis here.
I thought in like 87 when he was in the AWA, and forgive me for this, I was like in my very early 20s. I'm like, he should do a fat man gimmick. He should do a Crusher Blackwell thing as opposed to, doing the leather jacket or adorable Adrian. And now I realize that, that's weighing 400 pounds and being like, wow, he's a really good wrestler. It's just not a very healthy idea for the individual.
No. So, Adrian back then was always fantastic. Okay. Masa, I can speak of.
15 is Saito. I can't tell you anything specific about 1984, but we all know how good he was.
I can speak for it. He was, I believe he was with Choshu at that time.
He was.
And it was him, it was Masa, and it was, who's the guy that Andre broke his leg?
Killer Khan.
They were the early ones. So, and that was just, even like in ring, those guys were great. This was the height of their, of his. Yeah, wrestling power, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, just based on his overall career, I have no problem with Saito being 15. As a matter of fact, he could be a lot higher. I mean, I'm a little bit embarrassed. Like, we had Fuji and Saito up here as tag team champions in 81-82, and at that time, I didn't see how great Saito was. But, 5 years later...
Because you're too focused on the stink of Fuji.
Exactly. And 5 years later, I'm watching the videotapes on this guy, and he is phenomenal. So I could see him being higher.
Fuji, like the big anchor that he is, dragging everything else down around him.
16, Bob Orton Jr. I'm going to call this one, again, a reputation pick. In 84, he came to the WWF, and he way slowed down.
He didn't slow down. They slowed him down. I mean, that's still. The problem with that. But you're right, though. It is a reputation pick. He was so awesome in 1983. He was so reprehensible.
Year, he was in that tag team with Don Kernodal, and that was an excellent tag team. So maybe, maybe it's justifiable just based on that.
Yeah, I know. But Bob is so good. I mean, Bob was pretty much always the same. He was just good.
Okay, number 17 is Dick Slater. We already talked about him a little bit. I think 17 is fine for Slater in 1984.
No, and I would have him ahead of Brody, and I would have the next guy ahead of Brody, too.
Number 18 is Randy Savage. This is the reverse reputation pick. Not a lot of people knew about Randy Savage at this point. I'll guarantee you he was better than number 18 in 1984. I mean, just based on what I've seen in Memphis.
Every month they'd have the show in the Garden, and they would broadcast it on New England Sports Network, which was the local kind of sports centric, you know, cables, you know, sports channel, cable network, whatever. So on that show, it seemed to be the main event every time was Randy.
Yep,
it was Randy against. Randy against Hulk, Randy against Tito, Randy against Randy was awesome.
Yes, he was. Just to clarify, Nessun, this was the very early days of Nessun, and it suddenly became the thing where the away games, no, the home games for the Bruins and the Red Sox were televised, and they had WWF Wrestling starting, I think, August 1985.
Was it that late?
I believe so. It was the one with the main event of Morocco and Orton against Hogan and JYD.
Randy was on there all the time. So, and I've seen his stuff from Memphis in 84. Randy, this was the peak. By the time, it was one of those things, by the time Randy got famous, he wasn't as good as when he was not famous.
No, you know what? You're right, because his best wrestling was left in, you know, small arenas in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Indiana.
One thing about that is Jim Cornette would always say that the best, you know, some of his best matches and some of his knees were left on places in East Tennessee against Bobby Eaton in the late 70s.
I need a time machine for Randy Savage versus Bobby Eaton in 1979 in some small town in eastern Tennessee.
Yep.
Number 19 is Kerry Von Erich, who I feel gets we talk about overrated versus underrated. I think Kerry Von Erich today is very underrated.
He wasn't good in the ring.
He had
presence, he had, you know, he wasn't good in the ring. He shouldn't be on this list.
He was good in the ring.
Oh, he wasn't. He was okay. He should not be ahead of Ted DiBiase.
We'll get to that in a second. But I thought Kerry was excellent in the ring until, you know what, I was going to say until his foot injury, he started to slow down and lose interest, I would say, kind of towards the middle or end of 1985. But, I mean, I've seen him have so many good matches against so many different opponents. There's no way I'm not going to tell you that Kerry wasn't excellent, especially this is his peak.
He was Luger.
No way, man. No way.
He was Luger.
No way.
If you put him in with the right guy, he'd have a fine match. And if he's interested, keep in mind if he's interested, how many times does he have to pour himself into the ring?
Okay, that is true. I will give you that. In 19, was it 84 or 85 where he, Ric Flair, it was 85, Ric Flair got on TV and apologized for a match he had against Kerry Von Erich because apparently Kerry's dog died, and yeah, they had to pour him into the ring, and they made him go an hour regardless, which, you know, you have to adapt people.
He talked about the title change where he had to sit there and basically, you know why they did a backslide? It's the only move he could think of that he was confident that Kerry wasn't going to, you know, mess up.
I mean, that's Flair, and when you read
Fair enough.
His book, when
Fair
you were
enough.
Reading his book, you could tell Flair didn't like Kerry. And I get it. I can get why Flair didn't like Kerry, but I'm not Flair.
There's a ring of truth, though.
Yeah, but I've seen too many good Kerry Von Erich matches against various opponents where I just can't say Kerry stunk. He's
the lesser of the three brothers before Mike.
Huh?
When he was on, there's the keywords. He was the lesser of the three brothers before Mike. I think David's one, Kevin's two, I'll put him at three. We're just talking in ring. Kerry had way more charisma than the other two did.
I think Kevin at his peak was better than Kerry. David I thought was really good, but I'd put Kerry ahead of him.
I agree to disagree.
Me is, you know, talks about how good Kevin Von Erich was when he was in his prime. Number 20 is
good.
Ted DiBiase.
Who should be ahead of number 19. Ted's always 1984 Ted DiBiase. He's fantastic. He was in Georgia, right?
He was in Georgia the early part of the year, and towards the end of the year, he returned to Mid-South. He actually had an offer for the WWF
where, and they rarely did this, they told him, look, if you come here, we'll make you Intercontinental Champion just to show you that, hey, we're going to push you.
Ted was so awesome. He had this, I remember one of the aftermags had a picture of Ted on the cover. I'm thinking of this off the top of my head. With Ted in the cover with the black glove holding out the claw. And I think the headline was something like, can anyone stop Ted DiBiase?
I remember that.
Yeah.
DiBiase might have been the best heel I've ever seen in Mid-South. And I'm not talking Million Dollar Man, which I loved. But there was such a darkness about Ted DiBiase. Like, he would take out a guy like Hacksaw Jim Duggan or JYD the way I would kill a mosquito. He just didn't care.
And he was one of their best faces, too. And the different part about Ted than Butch is Ted would change his entire persona. And he made it work.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
A completely different guy.
He was a completely different guy, and nobody questioned a thing. As opposed to Butch, who was basically the same guy. He just hated the guys that you hate.
Now, here's a big reveal. I actually had a conversation with no less than Dave Meltzer about this list. This had to be 30 years ago, but it was about this list. And I said, wow, Ted DiBiase, who I considered an elite worker, like arguably number one, why is he number 20? And Dave, and this is why we framed it this way, we said this is January 1st, 84 through December 31st, 84. And Dave said that DiBiase had a down year in 1984. He was going through a divorce. He gained some weight, and his matches were not the caliber of Ted DiBiase matches that you were used to. And again, based on his reputation, I don't really notice that, but I also can't tell you anything great that Ted DiBiase did in the year of 1984.
He was also single-handedly propping up Georgia at this point.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. He made, by himself, he turned that show from unwatchable to watchable. I don't want to say by himself. They made some other upgrades too. But, I mean, DiBiase was just, you know, the star of the Georgia show until Black Saturday.
At no point in the 1980s should Ted DiBiase be any less than 15 on any list.
Like I said, he is an elite worker, one of the greatest of all time, in my opinion. And him being 20 here is a little bit weird, but at least, you know what? At least I got an explanation. All right,
yep. One other thing about Ted is that Ted and Bob Orton both have a similar thing where I think they're underrated because you never get to see bad Ted or bad Bob because they're always at a certain level. They're never bad.
No, they're never bad. Orton, you know what? When Orton was NWA in like 89, he was bad.
But that was 20 years into his career or whatever it was at that point.
Wasn't that quite that far. He wasn't even that old. He just, you know, he just got into a pattern of not being an elite worker, but which he was in like the late 70s, early 80s.
It's what the WWF does to you.
He told and Father Time. All right, we've got about 8 minutes left. Sean, pick out a wrestler and a number and give me your thoughts.
Okay, I can't let this one go. Number 23, Don Kernodle. I have been Don's champion for many of these episodes, saying that Dusty did him a wrong in 1985, and this proves me out. 23, by the smartest fans in the world, quote.
Yeah. Yeah, in terms of pure work rate, Kernodle was way higher than that. There is an alternative universe where he is part of like a Midnight Express tag team where they give him another great worker and they give him a manager and they put him out there and we're still talking about him today. I totally agree with you.
I have a proposition for you. What would have happened? I don't think it would have worked as well, but what would happen if they couldn't get Tully and they put Dawn with Wahoo?
I don't think it would have worked. I don't think Kernodle had – here's the thing. He was a phenomenal in-ring performer, and that's all he had going for him. He didn't have physical charisma.
He wasn't in an interview.
No. See,
the way you can push him as a top guy.
He was an interview as like a Iago kind of guy, behind the ears, like kind of just being that, you know, you had to have somebody else doing the main lines, someone else doing the thing, but he was the guy who kind of just chirp in and just kind of, you know, watch those interviews with him in Slaughter. You know, he would just sit there and he would look smug and he would look obnoxious. He would look like Ed Wiskowski sitting next to Buddy Rose back in the old Portland days. Yeah. When they were tag team champions, and Ed would sit there looking as smug as possible while Buddy's running somebody down. He had that kind of obnoxiousness to him, that which is why I thought, you know, again, Tully was so perfect for that role, though.
Yeah, they made a big mistake turning Kernodle, and you know what? I say that at one side of my mouth, then the other side of my mouth. It was time to turn him. And they came up with a really good angle, and for whatever reason, it just didn't happen for him. And when it didn't happen for him, there wasn't a role for him.
What about Don Knudel and Dick Slater?
I mean, as Dick Slater as Sergeant Slaughter, the guy he stood behind, sure.
That's what I mean.
Slater was too big a deal to be in the tag team. I mean, you know what? You could have had, like, Don Knudel and Tim Horner as a heel tag team with, you know, find your new Jim Cornette. I know there's only one Jim Cornette, but something along those lines. Then again, you can only have so many of those.
I know. I like his talent. I mean, I think his interviews are better than you're saying. In the ring, he was fantastic. He didn't have a physical charisma, but he had a physical presence to him that was
just
obnoxious human being.
Yeah, and like I said, they had to turn him. It was time. And
that's fair, but you could have turned him back. And I have the word for Dawn, insufferable.
yeah, that's. I mean, you had to turn him, and when they turned him, it didn't work. And when it didn't work, they kind of got cornered because they sold him as the pride of the Carolinas, and it's tough to turn a guy like that back.
I just thought of something fun. What if you brought Dawn to bring in Dawn as someone in the big town stars and have him give him a run against Lawler?
I mean, they could have done that. It would have worked on a Memphis level.
Put it with Jimmy Hart?
Yeah, you know, again, on a Memphis level, it would have worked. I mean, at the end of the day, Kernodle was a better Barry Horowitz, and Horowitz was really good.
I think he was more. I know. I think he's remembered as a because of how he's used. I think he was. I think Dawn was better than that.
I mean, I like Barry. He was better than Barry Horowitz. At the end of the day, like I wish he could have gotten that WWF contract where he had the full time job and he had kind of a Barry Horowitz role. But at the end of the day, from what I understand, he didn't want that. He was happy living in the Carolinas and didn't want all that, and that's cool. Let me bring up one that I think was weird. Roddy Piper at 34. I think that's way overrated. I know
he wasn't.
Piper was overrated in the ring.
How much was he in the ring? Oh, you mean overrated?
Yeah.
Oh no, yeah, he was overrated. He was okay. How are we defining work rate here?
When you get in the ring and try to put on a good match.
Okay, so but what I'm saying is, are we talking about the physical attributes of a match, or are we talking about whether the guy can go in and tell a good story?
I don't think Piper really did either. I mean, he just got in the ring and started swinging his arms at guys at this point.
Well, the reason I ask is Jerry Lawler does one, and I don't see him here.
Lawler is definitely on here. Hang on. I say that, not no. He's 57.
Oh, come on.
That's
absurd. Okay, so if that, because I think what they're saying is work rate, mistakenly, because if this is what you're judging a match on, you shouldn't be doing it, is just the pure physical attributes of the match. That's why Dynamite King's where he is. Dynamite Kid is where he is.
Yeah.
It's because of the physical attributes.
Star rating system.
Right. As a fan, I mean, that's fine. If you could do that, fine. But what I more care about is you telling me a story in the ring. You making this entertaining. That is what you are as a wrestler. Is you're a storyteller.
All right, I'm parceling out Jerry Lawler in 1984, and I'm trying to remember that one
big match that he has and nothing is ringing a bell?
Savage.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. He had the big the cage match with Savage was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Lawler on any year in the 80s should not be any lower than 20.
All right. And you know what? We are almost out of time. I'm going to end with this one. Terry Taylor at 65 is just so criminally underrated. Again, this is a reputation thing. But by the time 1984 came around, Terry Taylor was phenomenal.
An absolute top babyface. Even Dave Meltzer said it himself, who said he was one of the best at this point around 1985, that he was one of the best pure like baby faces around. He had that was lost upon everyone else, a little bit of darkness to him in Mid-South during his interviews. A little bit of annoyance. I have one more to bring up real quick. I just had caught this out of the corner of my eye. Hercules Hernandez at 36.
Hernandez had a heck of a run in Mid-South in 1984. He looked like, oh, you're going to love this. He looked like the next Bruiser Brody.
Fantastic. He should be down at 60 with Brody.
It's true, though. He looked like, in 1984, he absolutely looked like a future superstar.
Okay, I guess. But if you're talking just in-ring performance, he was never, ever, like an elite guy in the ring.
No, never. In
That's why I'm asking you what the definition is. Is it Lawler's kind of style? Because then I guess you can give Hernandez some slack. But if that is the style, what's Hernandez doing at 36?
I'm telling you, he had some really good matches in Mid-South. I'm recalling a really good match against Duggan. But just in general, he was considered a solid worker with an upside. So you know what? I have a few more seconds. One more I'm going to bring up is Lanny Poffo at 66. Lanny used to do that flip off the top rope, and that's all he could do. I know Lanny has a lot of internet fans. I don't have anything bad to say about the guy, but that is criminally overrated at 66. All he could do was that one spot.
No, I mean, yeah, by that point, yeah. Lanny earlier on, I mean, did Lanny have problems with his knees too?
No idea.
Because a lot of the stuff, particularly the Poffos, because of their style.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only so many times you can go from the top of the ring to the floor and not have problems. But his offense seemed very toned down by the time he got to the WWF as compared to what I saw in Memphis when I did get to see some of him.
Well, that's fair. Well, anyway, this has been a fun, exciting hour, and I am going to post this entire list, the entire top 100, on the Stick to Wrestling page. And, Sean, thank you for being with us once again. You're supposed to say you're welcome or something. I don't know.
Great to be here, John. Okay,
that works.
You never have me talk here, so go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I don't mean to silence you, sir.
No. You threw a curveball at me.
This has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Thank you all for listening. Have a good week.